It is a pleasure to be here for the Lord's Day. This is the day that Jesus arose from the dead. Every Lord's Day, I like to think about that day. And I hope that it was a sunshiny day on that day when He rose from the dead. But whether it was or not, it was a very happy day for Him, because His suffering and passion were all past. And He was ready to take up the new life, knowing that soon He would be going back to heaven. But what a joy it would be for Him on this day to know that the terrible suffering was over. The time of exaltation was before Him. So we can share in the joy of Jesus as He arose from the dead. Think about that today. Think about all that He's done for us. And I am so impressed with your elders. I have come to love them so quickly, being with them. They're good men and I appreciate them. And you have impressed me as a church to listen carefully. And so I wish you the best in your efforts to serve God and study His Word. In our study this morning, I've announced that we're talking about relevance or humanism. Unfortunately, this is an approach that, what I'm talking about is an approach taken in workbooks widely used among brethren. Produced and widely used among brethren. And it's not that anybody is deliberately setting out to be destructive of faith, but many times people have not given thought to what is actually going on. They haven't thought. You know, a lot of times we just take things handed to us by somebody else and we don't think about them ourselves. We don't evaluate them. We just accept them at face value and don't realize what we're doing when we do accept those things and when we use them. But the idea is, in many workbooks, that the Bible is not relevant to people. And so we are going to have to make it relevant. That it is especially not relevant to children. So we're going to have to figure out some way to make the Bible relevant. And a lot of times, even though we might see the lesson that is in Scripture, we may say, oh, I can't teach that lesson to the children because it might upset them or something like that. So we deliberately do not teach the lesson that is in that passage or that is in that book because we have made the judgment that it's not suitable for a child. Well, God put it there. And God commanded that the law be read to the entire population of Israel. And if it was acceptable for it to be read to them, then it would be acceptable for the children to learn the lessons. And so in many workbooks, what we have is an effort to avoid the lesson that is there. Many times the writer apparently doesn't know what lesson was there. And another lesson is invented and substituted for the lesson that was in the divine word. And the bottom line is that what is done is the divine element is removed from the story. Now, you would think somebody is deliberately trying to do this. I don't think that's the case. But it is amazing to what extent that is the very thing that is done, as I'm going to demonstrate to you from several very prominent examples that can be found in workbooks used among our brethren, among our churches. And this idea of humanism, the idea is that the Bible is simply not relevant. The Bible is not divine, it is not inspired, and therefore it is not relevant. And any use that is made of the Bible must be one that we give it. You see, it has no relevance of its own. We have to give it a relevance. Well, my view is that the God who gave us the Bible also made it relevant. He made the Bible relevant. And when I go into a class to teach that class, I will never convey the idea that this has no lesson. There's no point to this. It has no application except the one I give it. And so we go into the passage assuming that there is no lesson in the passage itself. I have to go in here and decide that this is the lesson we're going to teach from this passage. And when we take that approach, we wind up often being very destructive of the divine message that is there. Now, in the next hour of our worship, I'm going to talk about teaching the divinely intended lesson. And that lesson will be very closely related to this one. But in this lesson, I want to demonstrate to you what I am talking about. And I don't know any better way to do that than just to take some of the stories of the Bible and look at the way they're dealt with in various workbooks. It is assumed that the lessons included in Scripture are not the ones our children need to learn. Therefore, it appears that the Word of God is not what it is stated to be. Perhaps the Word of God is not inspired. Perhaps the Word of God is not profitable. Perhaps the Scriptures do not furnish us completely unto every good work. And so we have the choice of either saying the Scriptures are profitable as God gave them, or we have the option of saying, well, they're not profitable, but neither are they inspired, and they do not make us complete, furnishing us completely unto every good work. So let me begin now by showing you the examples that I have in mind. Now, the first example that I'm going to use is the story of Balaam. The story of Balaam occurs in Numbers 22. And what happens here is that the children of Israel have spent their 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. And now they have come up on the east side of the Jordan River. And they have fought and taken the kingdoms of Sihon and the kingdom of Og. And they have now conquered Transjordan. They come back and they encamp at the plains of Moab. Thus they are very close to the territory of Balak, the king of Moab. When Balak sees the great number of Israelites gathered together, it is frightening to him, because he knows he cannot overcome such a great crowd of people as that. So he consults with the elders of Midian. And Midian and Moab are joined together in this thing. And so Moab and Midian consult together about what they're going to do. So Balak, the king of Moab, decides that what he needs to do is he needs to curse the children of Israel, to put a curse upon them. We might say to put a hex upon them. But that meant he needed a curser. So he looked around and found the best curser that he could find. There was a guy who had a reputation as a curser. And this was not a C-U-R-S-O-R, but a C-U-R-S-E-R. He had a reputation far and wide as being a really good curser. And when he cursed somebody, man, they were cursed. If he blessed somebody, they were blessed. That was the man that Balak thought he needed. So he took of the princes of Moab and the princes of Midian, and he said, now you go up to this man whose name was Balaam. Balaam the son of Beor, who lived at Pethor on the river Euphrates, a long way north of Moab. So these princes of Moab and Midian took the rewards of divination in their hands, meaning they took money, silver, gold, whatever, to give to Balaam if he would do the cursing that the king of Moab wanted him to do. They took the rewards of divination, their bribes, their money with them. And they came to Balaam, and they came in and they said to Balaam, this is what the king of Moab says. If you will come down and curse the children of Israel, he will make you a rich man. So the king of Moab says, There's a people that's very numerous. They've come in here. They've just covered the ground. And I can't deal with them. I need you to come and curse them. So Balaam said, Well, now, you just come in and spend the night here, okay? You spend the night while I consult with my God, and I'm going to find out what my God says. Well, that night, Jehovah spoke to Balaam, and Jehovah said, Balaam, who are these men? Oh, these are men that have come from afar, and they want me to come and curse the children of Israel because they can't handle them, and they need help, so they want me to come and curse the children of Israel. God said, you shall not go, because these people are to be blessed and not cursed. So the next morning, Balaam came out, and he said to the princes of Moab and Midian, well, I can't go. You have to go back, because my God's not going to let me go. In other words, he was not happy about that. If you'd looked closely in Balaam's eyes, you would have seen cash register symbols, because he wanted that money. But the Lord had spoken. So the princes went back home to Moab, and they told the king there, he refused, and he said that his God would not let him come. Balak said, ha, every man's got his price. Take. And so he sent more elevated nobles, more money. And you go and you tell him now, tell him, you impress upon him how I can really do things for him if he will come and curse the children of Israel. So they went back. The princes of Moab and Midian went back. More elevated princes, higher princes. They went back to Balaam. And they said, the king of Moab, Balak, has sent us to you to get you to come and curse the children of Israel. And so Balaam said, well, wait a minute. I have to go ask my God. Hey, Balaam, come on. Do you have to go ask your God? Didn't you ask him before? Didn't he tell you then what he wanted you to do? But you see, Balaam is saying, wait here. I've got to go ask my God again. So he asked the Lord once again, can I go with these men? So God says, you may go with these men, but you better be careful to do only what I give you to say. And you better not do anything else. So Balaam comes back out. Hey, I can go. And so he saddles his donkey. He takes two servants with him. And he begins to travel, making his way back down to the area of Moab, where he's going to try to earn that money. So as he's heading down that way, he's riding his donkey. Now, he's ridden that donkey a long time, as we will learn. But as he's riding this donkey along, suddenly an angel of the Lord appears on the path right in front of the donkey with a sword drawn in his hand. That was a very frightening appearance. So very sensibly, the donkey decided he didn't want any part of that guy. So the donkey just suddenly turned and went off into the off the side of the road. If you've ever ridden a donkey very much, which probably you haven't, but if you've ever ridden a donkey, they don't gallop much. They plod along, and so it'd be easy to just almost be half asleep, you know. So it was rather a surprise to Balaam when his donkey just turns off and walks off the path. So he whack strikes the donkey. Get back in this path. Don't know what's wrong with this donkey. So they go along further. Second time the angel appears with that sword drawn. And this time they're going through a vineyard where there's a wall on either side. And there's not a lot of room. So when the donkey sees the angel, there is no space he can walk off into. So he just tries to go over to one side. And he crunches Balaam's foot up against the wall. And that made Balaam angry also. What is wrong with this donkey? So he took his stick and whack, he hit the donkey up a second time. So the donkey moved along a little further, and the third time the angel appeared, and this time there was simply no maneuvering room at all. Therefore, the donkey just lay down. So here Balaam is riding the donkey at one moment, and the next the donkey has just laid down. And Balaam is standing over the donkey. He takes his stick, whack, third time. And the donkey says, "Why have you hit me three times?" And Balaam doesn't say, "The donkey's talking." Instead, Balaam says, "It's because you've been making fun of me. And if I had a sword, I would kill you." And the donkey said, "Have I not been your donkey all of your life? Have I not been the donkey you've always ridden on? Have I ever acted this way before?" And Balaam said, "No." And at that point, the angel of the Lord opened Balaam's eyes so that he could see him as well as the donkey. And now Balaam saw the same fearsome sight that the donkey had been seeing all along. And now it was Balaam's turn to be afraid. And the angel said, "I have come out to be your adversary, Balaam, because your way is perverse before me." And so this is God saying, "I am your enemy. I have come out here as your adversary because your way is perverse before me." In other words, Balaam, what do I have to do to get you to do what I want you to do? Do I have to shout? Do I have to tell you, you do this and you can't do that? No, you can't do that. You must do this. What do I have to do? The Lord had already indicated what He wanted. You know, sometimes the Lord indicates to us what He wants, but we're not going to do it unless we think we've got to do it. So there was what Balaam did. Now, he went on down. He went on anyhow. He said, "Oh, I'll go back if you want me to." The angel said, "You may go on if that's what you choose. But you better not say anything but what I give you to say." Well, when Balaam did get down there, he could not curse the children of God. He simply could not open his mouth and curse the children of God. Every time he tried to do it, blessing would come forth. And Balak would say, "Hush, hush, don't say any more. It's better for you not to say anything than to say these blessings." And finally, Balaam wanted that money so bad that he figured out a way to do it. And so what he said was, "If I can get the children of Israel to do something that angers Jehovah, then He will punish them. He will curse them." So he advised Balak to send the Midianite women down into the camp of the Israelites with their gods and engage the Israelites in ritual fornication, worshiping their idols. And 24,000 Israelites were slain. Balaam got his money. But in a chapter later, in Numbers 31, we find that he didn't get to spend it. Because he was found when the Israelites took the vengeance of Jehovah upon the Midianites and the Moabites. Balaam was there. And they slew Balaam as well as the people of Midian for their part in causing the children of Israel to stumble. Now, that's the story as it is in the Bible. Can you see any lessons in that story? You see any points in that story? Balaam, your way is perverse before me. You're doing what you know I don't want you to do. And you're going ahead and doing it anyhow. Now, would that be appropriate? You think that's a lesson that children need? Do you think that's a lesson that all of us need? I would think so. But now I'm going to tell you how the workbook handled it. The workbook instructs the teacher, when the children come in, to say, How many of you have pets? So everybody talks for a minute about their cat or their dog or their goldfish. So we talk about our pets. And then we talk about Balaam. And I want you to see what a mean man he was. He mistreated his donkey. He was a bad man because he mistreated his donkey. Sweet donkey, and he mistreated the donkey. Do you ever mistreat your goldfish? You mistreat your dog, your cat? You mean thing. You should not be doing that. And so as good little boys and girls, we should not ever mistreat our pets. And so we have a handout. We have a handout that's prepared. And the handout is a picture to be colored, and it is of a boy pouring milk into a saucer for his cat. That's the lesson of Balaam. Don't be an animal mistreater. Don't be cruel to animals. That is the point of the story of Balaam. Because, you know, I mean, really, to teach the children about this idea, your way is perverse before the Lord, that you need to be attuned to the Lord's will and do what the Lord wants you to do without His having to twist your arm to do it. Now, that's not a lesson appropriate for children and people. We need to make this relevant. Now, do you see from that illustration what I'm talking about? Do you see that what was done was surgically, the divine element of the story was removed carefully, exactly, as you go in and operate and remove the divine element. It was totally removed. And the only thing left was an idea that any atheist in the country or any humanist in the country would be glad to be taught, which is be kind to animals. The environmentalist and the humanist of the country want us to be kind to rocks and trees and slugs and butterflies and crawfish while we slaughter unborn babies by the millions. So I am not very impressed by the crocodile tears of humanists who worry so much about being kind and sensitive. They totally miss the very important lesson that is taught here. Now, children that are taught this, as anyone using that workbook, I cannot imagine what any teacher looking at that would do. But a lot of times, the reason the teacher would use that workbook and use the lesson in that workbook is that the teacher doesn't even know what the point of Balaam is because they've never read the story. I heard of one teacher who was going to have occasion to teach the story of Joseph, and she told the class that I didn't read the story about Joseph because there must have been 100 chapters on it. So she hadn't read it because of how many chapters there were. She didn't even know how many chapters there were. She just saw that there was more than a little paragraph, and so she said there must be 100 chapters on it. I couldn't possibly read all of that. So somebody doesn't even read the story of Balaam in the Bible, so they take the workbook and teach that lesson. And if they do, so here you have the children. I want you to turn, please, to 2 Peter chapter 2. There are a couple of verses I want you to look at. And just sort of imagine what the impact would be. Here you have children who have been reared on the idea that the story of Balaam is teaching that we not be cruel to animals. So in 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 15, Peter is writing about the false prophets and the false teachers, men of no scruples and immoral and everything like that. And in verse 15, he describes them forsaking the right way. They went astray, having followed the way of Balaam the son of Beor. Whoever these people were that Peter was talking about here, the problem they had was they were animal mistreaters. Because, you know, that's what Balaam was, the way of Balaam. He was an animal mistreater. Therefore, the people here that Peter's talking about, the thing that was wrong with them was they were animal mistreaters. Another passage, Revelation 2 and verse 14, in the letter to the church at Pergamum. John writes of them, these are the words of Jesus, dictated to John. In verse 14, the Lord says to the church at Pergamum, "But I have a few things against thee, because thou hast there some that hold the teaching of Balaam." Oh, man. There at Pergamum, among all the other troubles they've got at Pergamum, they've got some animal mistreaters there. Now, the point of this is not that it's okay to mistreat animals. That's not the point. But it is not the point of Balaam to talk about that subject. That subject is not even in on the radar. And if that's what you teach out of the story of Balaam, then you have prepared those children not to have the foggiest notion of what the lesson of 2 Peter 2:15 and Revelation 2:14 is. And so it is outrageous to me. And its relevance or humanism. Instead of making that story relevant, they turned it into a humanistic story, teaching a humanistic point, a humanistic lesson. They removed the divine element totally from it. Another one that I want to use as an example is the feeding of the 5,000. Now this story, this miracle of Jesus is recorded in all four gospel accounts. In one of those gospel accounts, in John chapter 6, we have the story told. Here's the multitude gathered together, 5,000 men. Matthew adds the comment, besides women and children. So when you talk about the feeding of the 5,000, if you'll notice the comment in Matthew, then there probably were more like 15,000 total. So Jesus had them to have the people to seat themselves in groups of 50s and so on out here on the grass. And there was a lad there. Now John is the only account that mentions this lad. There was a lad there that had 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And so Jesus said, "Well, what is there that we can use to feed the multitude?" And Andrew said, "Well, there's a boy here that has 5 loaves and 2 fishes, but what are they among so many?" And Jesus said, "Bring it to me." And so he took these 5 loaves, and the loaves would have been fairly flat pieces of bread, like a hoe cake or a cornbread pone in shape. And he took the bread, and he broke the bread, and he began to distribute it. And the apostles carried the bread out to the multitude. And he broke the fish. And also, now you've got 2 fish. And these fish would have done well to be the size of my hand. And he just keeps doing that. Keeps doing that. Breaking it and breaking it and breaking it and breaking it. And he's handing it out and handing it out. And the apostles keep walking out carrying some food and supply of food that he's given them and distributing it to the multitude. And they keep on and on and on and on until everybody says, "No thanks, I've had enough. Okay, no more. I've had enough." 15,000 people fed with 5 loaves and 2 fishes. Now John, who tells us of this miracle, also tells us in John 20, verses 30 and 31, what the purpose of Jesus' miracles was. "Many other signs therefore did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, and that believing you may have life." That's the purpose of these miracles. This was a miracle. It was a miracle Jesus did to show that he was who he said he was, that he was the Son of God. Now, is that a relevant lesson? Is that something that we need? Is it something that our children need? I would think so. But in almost every workbook I have ever examined for children, the point that is made from that story is we all ought to share. You know, one of the things that children must be taught is to share. Have you kids ever been taught to share? You remember that? I did not grow up in the Lord's church. I was up a good sized boy when we began to attend worship. So I didn't hear the lesson of sharing. I learned to share fairly well eventually. But I did not hear this thing about sharing, but I sometimes think from all that I've heard, if I were a child, I would be bored silly by hearing share so many times. As if the only thing we need to learn to be Christians is share. And like everything else, whether it's love God, trust God, fear God, share, be good boys and girls, whatever it is, you'll never, never accomplish it by telling them they're supposed to. You have to make them want to. You have to make it the thing that is the thing to do. And so we take the stories and we just make every story share. We say, now here's the deal. The men say, you know, men, elders, men say, all right, you women, you're supposed to teach these little kids the epistles. Yeah. Well, what you women ought to do is to say, well, why don't you men teach them the epistles? And after the men try teaching them the epistles once, they will not do that again. Children are not ready. Little children are simply not ready to study epistles. But what they have to do, they say, oh no, I've got to study Philippians with the 4-year-olds. What in the world am I going to be able to do? Oh, here is something about sharing. All right, Philippians is about sharing. We ought to be good boys and girls. And we ought to share the stuff we've got, like Philippians shared it with Paul. Now I've got to study Ephesians. What am I going to do with Ephesians? Oh, here's something about sharing. Oh, good. Ephesians is about we need to be good boys and girls, and we need to share. And now I've got to study Hebrews with these little kids. And what am I going to teach about Hebrews? Here's something about sharing. Well, why don't we teach them they need to be good boys and girls and share? Well, it begins to sound like that Romans and 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians and Galatians and Ephesians and Philippians and Colossians are all about being good boys and girls and sharing. So we go in and we want to make everything about sharing. Now, does this mean that there is never a time that you should talk about sharing? No, it doesn't mean that at all. A good place to teach sharing would be in Acts 2. When the point is that the early disciples gave what they had to the apostles, laid it at the apostles' feet, to be given to those that had need. They did not count it as their own, but they were willing to share it with others that were in need. And Acts 4 and Acts 6, because that's the point being made. So how is this handled in the workbooks about the feeding of the 5,000? The point is made that there was this little boy, and he was a good little boy, and he shared his lunch. Well, as my wife pointed out, if the story of the feeding of the 5,000 is about a boy that shared his lunch, then two people would have eaten. But it wasn't two people that ate, the boy and whoever he shared his lunch with. 15,000 people ate from 5 loaves and 2 fish. It was a miracle. There is absolutely no emphasis whatever on the fact that the boy shared the lunch. Now, I'm pretty sure he did it voluntarily. I can't see Jesus and Andrew just snatching it out of his hands with him crying, saying, "I don't want to share it." But that's not the emphasis. There's just no emphasis on that whatever. So one of the points is that we go into that and we say, "Oh, how can we make the children understand this? How can we make this relevant for the children?" Well, the way you do it is teach it like it says it. And teach the point there. Because there's a lesson that children need to get above all. And that is that Jesus is who He said He was. That He is the Son of God. He is Christ. He is real. Heaven is real. The Bible is real. This is not a fairy tale. A lot of young people grow up with the conviction that that's pretty well what it is. And then it has no power in their lives. Because we have removed the divine element. Do you see in that story, again, what we've done is we've gone in and we've surgically removed the divine element, the element of the emphasis upon the deity of Jesus and the power that He used to manifest that deity in feeding the multitude. We just removed that. And we've made it a story that any atheist or any humanist could approve of, the idea of being kind of human beings and share what you have. Being humanitarian. See that? And we have just removed the divine element. Well, now that brings me to my third illustration. This is the classic. So I've saved the best for last. Through the years, as I've traveled in meetings and been in homes and everything, I've had people talk to me about, "Oh, we really are conscientious about teaching our children." Well, good. That's very good. We even have Bible videos for our children to watch. And invariably, I am asked to watch this video and tell them what I think. Well, to this day, I have never yet seen a Bible video that I would recommend. "Oh, but this one is all the words of Matthew. It just uses the words of Matthew." One time I was contacted by a video company that wanted me to look at one. So they sent it to me. Under protest, I said, "Okay, I'll look at it." So it came, I put it in, and I started watching it. And so, sure enough, it started off with the people doing their acting and everything, and they were using the words of Matthew. Then it got to the Sermon on the Mount. And it had Jesus standing up there, and He's walking around, everybody seated around, including His apostles. They were all seated around there. And so Jesus is talking in the Sermon on the Mount now, see? So He says, He walks over here in the midst of it, and He reaches down as He's talking, and He picks up a big bucket. And He walks over here, "Ask and you shall receive." And just pours it all out over Andrew or Thomas, one of the apostles. Just dumps it all out. "Ask and you shall receive. Seek and you shall find." The words of Matthew. But are the children going to remember the words of Matthew that they hear? Or are they going to remember Jesus pouring a whole bucket of water over Andrew? I sent the video back. And I told them that I wouldn't recommend it at all. But this video, I went to a meeting and the preacher and his wife, they're just so fine. Just very conscientious. So they had a video of Daniel in the lion's den that they had their children watching because this would be a way of teaching Bible to their children. They wanted me to watch it. So, what I'm going to do now is I'm just going to step down from up here and I'm going to step out here and I'm going to tell you about that video. The video starts off Now this is going to be so exciting that you must contain yourself. All right, the video starts out with these three children, and they're running madly all over the place like somebody's after them. And they run into this warehouse to find a place to hide. Somebody's after them. I didn't watch it a second time, so I don't know whom they were running from. I confess. But as they were running around in this warehouse, they came to this door, which was a magic door. You can always tell a magic door because blue light is shining out from the cracks. So they went to this door, and they opened the door, and they went through the door, and boy, they went through a time warp. You can tell a time warp because there's a circle, kind of a corkscrew type thing going like that. And they just kind of fall out on the floor. By the way, periodically, I will remind you, this is a video of Daniel in the lion's den. I will remind you of that occasionally. So now they kind of just tumble out on the floor like they come through this long tunnel. And they kind of dump out here on the floor. And they get up and they look around. And one of the first things they see is that there is a caravan of wagons going along here. And it's an old circus. That's what it is. It's a circus moving along here. And there is a lion in one of the cages made of wood, you know, and the wagon, the wheels rolling along. And the lion is in this cage, and he is a really big lion. He is a big, strong lion. And he's just roaring and shaking the cage, and nobody can even get close. This lion has a ferocity that you just can't imagine. And nobody knows what to do with this lion. Well, finally, this kind of a young guy, he tentatively approaches the cage, and he goes and he sees that in the lion's paw there is a thorn. And so he very slowly reaches, and the lion lets him, and he takes the thorn, pulls the thorn out, and oh, that felt so good to get that thorn out. The lion just looks at his paw, and he looks at this guy that took the thorn out, and he just really imprints the face of that guy that took the thorn out. Because that was Daniel, see, who took the thorn out. Well, then Daniel gets in trouble with the king. And of course, I'm not telling you the story of Daniel in the lion's den. What I'm doing is telling you about the video of Daniel in the lion's den. But he got in trouble with the king. And so the king, well, before I tell you that part, I've got to tell you this part. The owner of the lion, the owner of the circus, said, well, now what am I going to do with this lion? I can't keep this lion. And they said, well, sir, why don't you give him to the king? And he can put it in his den of lions. Because he likes to have fierce lions. Now already you can begin to see the plot thicken. So this big old mean lion is given to the king and is put in his den of lions. Daniel gets in trouble with the king, and Daniel's going to be put down in the den of the lions. So when the king takes Daniel, puts him down in the den of the lions, the king's all worried about it. And the king goes back to his court and he waits, and the next morning he comes down, and what happened when Daniel was put down in that lion's den, all of the lions looked at him and they thought, aha, fresh meat. But there was one of the lions that looked a little more carefully, and he said, hey, I know you. And this was the biggest, strongest lion of all the other lions. And this lion goes over there and gets in front of Daniel. And he won't let any of the other lions come and bother Daniel at all. And so that lion keeps the other lions off Daniel all night because he so appreciated Daniel's removing the thorn out of his paw. And so the next morning the lion had saved Daniel from the other lions. Now, what was I supposed to say to the family that wanted me to watch that because it was such a good video? I was appalled, and to this day, I am appalled. Because the Bible says that when Daniel, and I have to tell you this, the enemies of Daniel went to the king and they said,
You know, among themselves, they said, we're not going to find Daniel doing anything we can accuse him of unless we put him in conflict with between his God and the laws of the land. So they went to the king and got him to agree to sign a decree that if anyone asks a petition of a god or a man for 30 days other than the king himself, then he was to be cast into the den of lions. And the king, without realizing what they were up to, signed that. They knew that Daniel prayed 3 times a day, and when Daniel heard of the decree, he immediately went to his room and prayed to God. And so he prayed to God, he got caught, and the king tried everything he could to get him out of it, to not have to put him down in the den of lions. But the enemies of Daniel said, no, no, no. And they made the king go through with the decree. So as the king was putting Daniel down in the lion's den, he said, fear not, Daniel, your God whom you serve continually, he will deliver you from the lions. And that night he could not find any comfort in music or anything else. He could hardly wait until daylight. And when daylight was come, he went down to the den, and in a plaintive voice he says, Daniel, has your God whom you serve continually, has he been able to save you? And Daniel said, fear not, O king, because my God has sent his angel to close the mouths of the lions, and they have done me no harm. According to the Bible, it was the God of heaven who saved Daniel. It was the God of heaven who sent an angel who closed the mouths of the lion. It was not another lion. Do you see what that video does? It just completely removes the divine element from the story and makes Daniel saved by another lion whom we learn to love instead of God. Now this is the thing that I'm saying. We must be careful that in our efforts to make application, that we not wind up making the wrong application to the point that we remove the divine element from the story. And we wind up teaching humanism instead of making it relevant. So in the next hour, we will talk about teaching the divinely intended lesson. That'll be the end of it at this point, because it's 10 till.